views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
On the cutting edge of the new mainstream, Christine Upchurch is passionate about bringing together science, psychology, and spirituality in a way that can be applied to our everyday lives for true transformation. The Christine Upchurch Show, stellar conversations to illuminate your journey, engages some of the most inspired visionaries on the planet in lighthearted, lively dialogue. Join us as we explore the expansive nature of reality in a down-to-earth way, offering you insights and tools empowering you to become that bright light you're meant to be. Now, here's your host, Christine Upchurch.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Christine Upchurch Show. We are so glad you've joined us here today, here on KKNW AM 1150 or Transformation Talk Radio anywhere around the world, or on one of the, I think it's 90 different syndicated stations. Or perhaps you're listening after the fact on ChristineUpchurch.com. But wherever and whenever you're listening from today, we are going to be talking about something we have never talked about before, and it is important for each and every one of us. But before I get into that, I have to say hello to my better half here in the studio who does his magic so you can hear this wonderful conversation, Mr. Benny Mathers. Good morning, Benny.
I'm so frustrated. I'm so angry.
Are you angry? You are frustrated.
Can I be cured today? Can we help this out?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay,
yes.
The right show.
And I think it's a really important to be able to allow people to process their feelings, particularly in this day and age of the social media negative rhetoric. And, you know, that we have conflict in all aspects of our lives. So this is a really important topic. We are going to be talking about how to de-escalate these powerful, you know, somewhat negative emotions. We, you know, I put the negative in quotes because they're just feelings.
And for the record, I'm really not angry.
Okay. I feel so much better.
You've calmed me down already.
I accept however you feel, Benny. You know that.
Didn't want to alert anybody. They're like, "Ain't Benny's angry? Is that even possible?" No, it's not possible.
Yeah. Well, our guest today is Douglas Knoll, and he is the author of De-Escalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. And he is a full-time, internationally recognized mediator and peacemaker. And he specializes in difficult, complex, and intractable conflicts. He is an attorney. He's a fellow of the International Academy of Mediators on the American Arbitration Association panel of mediators and arbitrators. And mediation is not always easy. I've seen it firsthand. He's been listed as one of the best lawyers in America since 2005 by U.S. News and World Report. He's a Northern California super lawyer. And he's one of 193 mediators worldwide selected for inclusion in the International Who's Who of Commercial Mediators. And he is an award-winning author of four books. And this latest book, what I said before, is De-Escalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. I'd like to welcome our guest today, Douglas Knoll. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Christine. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here. You know, I always get fascinated with how a person's life path has led them from point A to point B, or point A to point Z, you know, whatever it is. How did you go from being an attorney to being a peacemaker?
Kind of like the same way you went from being a PhD in mathematical statistics to being a healer.
You peaked, didn't
Except
you?
I didn't get sick.
Well, my story goes like this,
but it's the same. It was you'll understand the trajectory. So I graduated from law school in 1977 and clerked for a year for a judge, and then went into private practice in 1978 and tried my first, that was in September of 1978, and tried my first jury trial in November of 1978 as a young associate in a law firm, and just became a hardcore trial lawyer for 22 years. Along the way, I started studying the martial arts, Northern Chinese Kung Fu style, and just about the time I turned 40, I was awarded my second degree black belt.
Okay.
My teacher called me in after he gave me my second degree and said, "You're done here. You're too arrogant. You're too violent. You're going to hurt somebody. I'm not going to teach you anymore until you go master Tai Chi."
Wow.
Well, I didn't know it at the time. Yeah, wow. I didn't know it at the time, but that was a death sentence because you never master Tai Chi.
Uh-huh.
So I found a teacher and I started studying and learned of two paradoxes. The first is the softer you are, the stronger you are.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is the more vulnerable you are, the more powerful you are.
Interesting.
Well, in the beginning, these paradoxes didn't compute.
Right.
Because I was hard warrior type. But eventually, they began to soak into my soul. And as a result, I learned how to manipulate chi, and that led me to pranic healing, and I became mm-hmm. a healer and was on a deep spiritual path.
An attorney who's a healer. Now, there's an oxymoron.
Well, actually, there are quite a few of us around.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
So I got into energetic healing and was really kind of astounded that I had a knack for it and was able to get good results. And then, so one day, so this was all going on in the 90s. In the mid to late 90s, I was in the courtroom one day cross-examining somebody, and the thought came to me, what the heck am I doing here?
Mm-hmm.
So after that trial, I had a vacation plan to do a river trip up in Idaho, the Maine Salmon. So with a bunch of friends, we spent 10 days on the Maine Salmon, and I spent the trip in my raft all by myself just thinking about how many people I'd served as a trial lawyer and mm-hmm. concluded that really out of all the hundreds of matters that I'd handled, only two or three people had come out of the system better off than going in.
Oh, wow.
And I thought that really is not a good... I mean, by any measure, I had a very successful trial career, but uh-huh. that was the measure that really counted. Serving people just wasn't there.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I don't think I'm going to be doing this much longer.
Uh-huh.
So I came back home, drove down out of the mountains to my office, and as I was driving down, I heard the one and only public service announcement on our local public radio station for a new master's degree
uh-huh.
in peacemaking and conflict studies.
Oh, wow.
Peacemaking and conflict studies being offered at Fresno Pacific University, which is the West Coast Mennonite University. And the mm-hmm. Mennonites are one of the three traditional Protestant peace churches.
You bet.
So that caught my attention. And eventually, that fall, I signed up and became a full-time master's student. So for 3 years, I was a full-time master's student, a full-time trial lawyer, and a three-quarters time law professor. It was pretty crazy.
Oh, my goodness. How did you fit in all that stuff?
Well, it was... That was the end of my first marriage. Anyways, the guys, my mentors, completely switched my thinking around about human conflict. I began to understand and comprehend a whole bunch about what it takes to make peace and what conflict is all about and how we as human beings deal with all of this and recognized that the law had some very severe limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, many of the problems that the law is asked to deal with, it was never designed to deal with in the first place. Because mm-hmm. structurally in our society, we don't have ways of resolving conflict other than hiring a junkyard lawyer and going and asking him to duke it out.
Uh-huh.
But I had walked so many people out of the courtroom where we won the case, and I'd done brilliant legal work, if I don't uh-huh. say so myself.
Right.
And the clients were really frustrated because they didn't feel like they got justice.
Uh-huh.
So, and they wouldn't pay me.
Oh, my goodness. They didn't pay you.
So ultimately, I left the practice in 2000. I just walked away from a multi-million-dollar law practice, left a bunch of money in the firm, mm-hmm. just walked away and said, I'm done, and became a full-time peacemaker and mediator.
Wow.
And that's how it kind of happened. And I did everything that I told my clients not to do. I had no business plan. I had no money saved away. I had no nothing. I just trusted to the universe
uh-huh.
that things would happen. And today, here I am 17 years later, and I don't make nearly the money I made as a lawyer,
uh-huh.
but I have helped more. I help more people in a month than I helped in 22 years as a lawyer. And here's the really cool thing that my life—I say that my life really began at 50.
Uh-huh.
So when I left the firm. So in 2009, a colleague of mine, Laurel Crawford, down in Los Angeles, called me and said, "Hey, I want to read a letter to you that I just got." She was standing at her mailbox, and it was a letter from a woman who was serving a life sentence without possibility of parole.
Mm-hmm.
In the largest, most violent women's prison in the world.
Oh, dude.
And she was asking Laurel to come in and teach the lifers how to be mediators to stop the violence.
Mm.
And Laurel asked me if I'd want to do that with her, and I thought about it. I said, oh, this would be very cool. And so that's how the Prison of Peace Project started, which has been, to this date, the most important transformative work either she or I have ever done.
And from what I've read in your book, it sounds amazing. But before we get into that, I just want to take a step back and have you define for us what conflict is.
Oh, that's a really good question. Depends on who you ask.
Mm-hmm.
Conflict, For me, conflict is any really is composed of two parts. First, on the objective level, conflict is any situation in which two people feel they perceive that they have conflicting needs, goals, and desires.
Okay.
And they feel that the only way that they can meet those needs, goals, and desires is by beating the other guy up.
Uh-huh.
And at the subjective or more emotional level, conflict arises to conflict when there are strong emotions that are associated with it, which would be anger and frustration primarily.
Uh-huh.
But also in relationships, sadness, grief, abandonment, betrayal, that sort of thing.
Right.
So conflict has a strong emotional component to it, and it has a perceptive component where people feel like they're being thwarted in their ability to get what they want mm-hmm. by another person or
right.
group of people.
Right. So I know that generally speaking, when we have some sort of conflict, people want to go into it with the win-lose kind
That's
of
right.
mentality. Mm-hmm. And what's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that typically most conflicts will never be resolved by a win-lose mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that people go to that is because if you think about when you were 2 years old, what was the first conflict resolution method that you learned? You get spanked or sent to your room
uh-huh.
and punished. And so you learn very quickly that he or she who has the most power wins.
Right.
And most people never get out of that two-year-old mentality and never learn that there are far more sophisticated ways of dealing with conflict other than coercion. So they always believe, since that was the first training, that's the deepest within us, we are in this idea of coercion and beating up the other guy and winning at all costs is sort of at the foundationally how we look at conflict. And anything else is weak
mm-hmm.
because we remember from 2 years old that we had no power, we were extremely weak, and weakness is bad.
Yeah, yeah. This
so
is fascinating.
It goes all the way back to how we were trained as children
mm-hmm.
and how children are being trained today.
And how old we are emotionally in our interactions, I imagine, too.
That's right.
We have to go to a quick break, but when we return, I'm going to want you to talk about mediation, what it is, and what are some of the skills we can learn with any kind of conflict in order to de-escalate? More with Douglas Knoll here in just a few moments.
Chris Stainis is a spiritual leader and healer and teaches a course on how you can transform your life through a meditation and healing system that will manifest your spirit's dreams. She manifested the Women of Wisdom Conference, the Women of Wisdom book, and this radio show. And she can show you how to change your life too. Are you ready? Visit the website and contact her at voicesofwomentoday.com. That's voicesofwomentoday.com.
What is a brilliant culture? And how do we create them? Why are they important? Claudette Rowley has created a breakthrough five-step process to help you design a culture that is authentic, innovative, and successful. Learn how to create change with Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence, and Claudette Rowley. To learn more or work with Claudette, visit ClaudetteRowley.com.
The goal for the Art of Powerful Living Radio is to inspire every human to live lives that are rich, fulfilling, on purpose, and fun. This hit show with Robert Schoenfeld is a fresh approach to boldly living our lives with creativity, courage, patience, wisdom, love, and power. Join Robert every month with Dr. Pat Basile for the Art of Powerful Living Radio.
On the cutting edge of the new mainstream, Christine Upchurch is passionate about bringing together science, psychology, and spirituality in a way that can be applied to our everyday lives for true transformation. The Christine Upchurch Show, stellar conversations to illuminate your journey, engages some of the most outstanding visionaries on the planet in lively dialogue to inspire you to become that bright light you're meant to be. Join Christine every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time on KKNW, AM 1150, and Transformation Talk Radio.
I'm Christine Upchurch, and this is a Stellar Reflections Minute. For centuries, spiritual traditions have talked about how humans have an energy field, or aura, surrounding them. Although skeptical scientists refuted this for decades, science is now beginning to catch up with spirituality. Scientists can actually measure light emanating from living beings, so they can measure the human aura, which in scientific terms is known as the biofield. Many medical practitioners around the world use an instrument to evaluate a patient's biofield for the purpose of diagnosing illness. They understand that imbalanced or insufficient light in a person's energy field indicates a physical or emotional problem. The good news? There are ways to balance and increase your light, resulting in greater well-being. For more information, please check out stellarreflections.com or call 425-999-9836. That's 425-999-9836.
Welcome back to the Christine Upchurch Show here on KKNW and Transformation Talk Radio. You know, Doug, I'm fascinated by this concept that we can de-escalate conflict. And you've been a mediator for many years. What is mediation?
So probably the easiest way to think about mediation at its most basic level is a facilitated negotiation. When we negotiate, we're just two or three people or two or three parties, and they are negotiating back and forth using certain social rules about how to reach an agreement on something.
Mm-hmm.
When they are no longer able to negotiate, either because their emotions are too high or because the problem is too complex or whatever issues might be out there, you would think about bringing in a mediator to help you through a process that keeps people calm, or if they're escalated, de-escalates them and calms them down,
mm-hmm.
and then leads people through a process where they can really look at their choices that are in front of them and make the best choice they can with the information they have.
Mm-hmm.
And many times in mediation, it's not about making good choices. It's about making the least worst choice.
Right. So is it all about the information? You know,
Well, that's a large part of it. Having information and sharing information is critical so that people can understand what they have in front of them.
Uh-huh.
But when I teach mediation, I basically say two steps: de-escalate, then problem solve.
Uh-huh.
And you're going to be doing this all throughout the whole process, all day long, however long this mediation lasts, whether it's a day or a month or whatever. You're going to constantly be de-escalating people because they're going to get triggered.
Mm-hmm.
And once they're de-escalated, then you can problem solve with them until they de-escalate again. And then you just iterate the process.
So what you're saying is dealing with the emotions first is an essential part of coming up with an agreement.
It's critical. Think about how many people try to problem solve an emotional person. You cannot solve an emotional problem with logic.
Mm-hmm.
Our brains just are not set up for that.
Right.
That's
the Western culture. That's what we think we're dealing with.
Exactly.
It's all about convincing the other person of our perspective.
Totally wrong. Goes all the way back to the Greeks. They were wrong. The Neoplatonists were wrong. Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, was wrong. You know, the Enlightenment was in many ways led us astray.
Ah.
We're 98% emotional and 2% rational.
And
emotions drive every single thing that we do, including rationality.
So you just gave us a statistic. Is there science to back that up?
Absolutely. In terms of the de-escalation process, I stumbled upon this skill by accident in a mediation in Santa Barbara in 2004, and for years wondered why did this work?
Uh-huh.
Until I came across a study done by neuroscientist Matthew Lieberman at UCLA, and Lieberman and his associates put people into scanning machines, so they're going to watch their brain real-time in fMRI machines,
uh-huh.
and they would show the people clips of evocative movies, for example, and then they would watch what happens to the brain. So you'd see, for example, the opening scenes of Sophie's Choice, very, very powerful scene.
Yes.
And people's emotional centers would light up. And then they would do a bunch of techniques on them to see what would work. And when they were really testing to see why affect labeling worked, this technique. And so when they actually just simply stated the emotion that they thought that the subject was experiencing in the moment, the emotional centers of the brain immediately quieted down, and the prefrontal cortex came back online. And it was the only kind of reflection that had that effect. Every other kind of reflection that people have been teaching forever if anything, made the emotional centers more excited.
So in other words, our emotions on some level need to be seen or somehow validated in order to calm them.
Validated is the right word. There's this process. It's very complex. Emotions are far more complex than what we imagine them to be. But essentially what happens is when we become emotional, our ability to process our experience gets short-circuited because the prefrontal cortex is being overwhelmed by information. It literally shuts down.
Uh-huh.
So we have an emotional experience, but we can't process it. And if we can't process it, then we're just reactive. We're slaves to whatever our programming is.
Right.
So when we engage in this de-escalation technique, which I can describe in a moment, what happens as the listener is we are actually lending our prefrontal cortex to the speaker, to the person who's emotionally charged, that allows them to process their emotional experience unconsciously very, very quickly, less than 90 seconds.
Wow.
Works
90
first
seconds.
Time, every time, without failure. Because that's the way our brains are hardwired.
So what is this process?
Get out a piece of paper, write this down, 3 rules, 3 steps, quiz at the end. I'm a law professor, can't help myself. All right, step number 1. When you're confronted with somebody who's really angry, 2-year-old child, 90-year-old person, doesn't matter who they are, what they are, what their status is to you, they're just really upset. Let's take anger, for example.
Uh-huh.
First thing you have to do is, for the next 90 seconds, is ignore the words. If you start paying attention to the words, you're going to get triggered. And then you get escalated, and you're in the cycle and the vortex, and there's nothing you can do. So ignore the words. The words for the next 90 seconds have no meaning.
Okay.
It's just noise. Second step. Guess what the emotions are, the feelings are, that this person is having. Typically, if it's anger, it's going to be anger. But it's going to be a whole lot of other stuff, too.
Uh-huh.
Anger is just the presenting emotion, but there's a whole lot of stuff underneath it. Guess what those might be. And then the third step, which is the most counterintuitive, is reflect back that emotional experience with a very simple you statement. You are angry. Christine, you're really angry.
Mm-hmm.
You're really pissed off. You're frustrated. You're sad. You feel like you've been betrayed. Nobody's supporting you. Nobody's listening to you. Feeling a lot of grief right now. And all of that is just culminated in rage.
Right.
Okay. And that's all you do. And you wait for 3-4 things to happen that are going to happen unconsciously with the speaker. Number 1. They're going to nod their head affirmatively, up and down. 2, they're going to give you a verbal response like, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. And 3, they're going to drop their shoulders. And 4, they're going to sigh. This is all happening unconsciously. They don't even know they're doing it. And you watch for that. When you see
so
those four
really,
things happen.
It's always those 4 things?
Yep, it's always those 4 things. Those are your indicators that you've quieted everything down and things will slow down. And then you can start moving into problem solving if that's what you need to do.
Okay.
So, the things that you don't want to do, and I'm explicit about this because all the science shows us that it does not work, even though this is what conveyed wisdom tells us to do. We don't use I statements. Gee, Christine, it seems to me that you're really angry, or I hear that you're really angry, or I am sensing that you're really angry. No I statements.
That's surprising because what if... If you're saying you are angry or you are this and you're wrong.
Oh, that's even better because you're probably not wrong. But what's going on is because you're allowing the speaker to process what you're saying, the speaker has the opportunity to correct you. And so I could say, Christine, you're really angry. And you say, no, I'm not angry. I'm just enraged.
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, you're really enraged. You are enraged. You are really, really enraged. And yeah, that's exactly how I am. So even though you're guessing at the feelings, you're never wrong because your speaker will immediately correct you and you come back with a correction.
Okay.
And every time you do this, I mean, if you ever check in with people, they will tell you, thank you so much for listening to me. You helped me understand what I was feeling, and the fact that you might have been wrong or I might have been wrong just helped me get into it even deeper.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no error here. The second thing that you don't want to do is you don't want to ask a question. Are you angry?
Uh-huh.
So you never ask a person how they're feeling. You just tell them how they're feeling and allow them to process that information and then give you feedback about where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
And you just keep doing that until you get these 4 autonomic responses, and then you quit.
Wow.
Whole thing takes less than 90 seconds.
Okay, so you alluded to something before that I think is important for people to be aware of. And you were talking about how when somebody's angry, there are usually all sorts of other emotions associated with it. But typically, many of us will just see the anger.
Right.
What is often beneath the anger?
So you'll see, it comes in five layers. So you'll see anger and rage and frustration at the top. Then under that are kind of what I call dignitary things. They're not really emotions, but they're close enough. That would be disrespect, not being listened to, feeling like you're being treated unfairly, not being supported. Then underneath that is going to be the fear emotions, fear and anxiety, being frightened. Underneath that, layer four, is going to be sadness and grief.
Mm.
Underneath that, shame, humiliation. And actually, there are six layers. The sixth layer is feeling unloved, abandoned, and completely all alone in life.
Wow, that's powerful for one, you know, angry outburst.
And that's what's there. They're all there. They are all there at some level or another. And how deep you go depends upon your circumstance. When I'm working in prisons with inmates, I'll demonstrate this, and I'll get some burly guy up there who's all tatted up and looks like he's walked out of some Rocky horror movie, you know, and I'll have him in tears in 30 seconds.
Wow.
Literally breaking down, because I can go right to his core. And I warn him ahead of time, who wants to come up and cry? You're not dealing with guys that are lifers, right?
Yeah.
And women, too, when I'm in the women's prison.
Right.
Same thing. But you can go very deep. Now, how deep you go is totally dependent upon relationship and context.
And what
the needs are of the moment.
So what do you mean in terms of relationship and context?
Well, supposing I'm engaged to do some mediation. I've got somebody who's really escalated, and let's say it's some sort of corporate dispute, business dispute. Well, there are certain cultural rules around what emotions are appropriate to be displayed and what aren't. And in corporate America, anger and frustration are appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Sadness, grief, shame, humiliation, loneliness are absolutely inappropriate.
Right.
So I wouldn't go there unless I had to because... that's what it was going to take, but I would be very careful about going there.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm talking to a 2-year-old who's having a tantrum, I'll go right down to the bottom.
Yeah.
Fast, because that's what's driving the tantrum.
That makes sense. We have to go to another quick break, but when we return, I'm going to want you to share some of your wonderful examples of how you have not only shifted a conflict and de-escalated that, but how that has changed lives. More with Douglas Knoll here in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
I'm Christine Upchurch, and this is a Stellar Reflections Minute. What does the word healing mean? Many think that healing merely means eliminating symptoms. However, based on my many years as a healer, I have a much broader perspective on the word. Healing can manifest in a variety of ways, including having physical problems resolved, becoming more emotionally centered, experiencing better relationships, gaining greater clarity, and feeling more spiritually connected. True healing always includes some level of transformation. Whatever form healing takes, there is one commonality, an improvement in quality of life. To me, the highest form of healing goes beyond aligning with wellness. It comes from recognizing our soul's voice and allowing it to speak through us. And in that sense, don't we all yearn to heal into our wholeness? Please visit StellarReflections.com or call 425-999-9836. That's 425-999-9836.
Hi there, my name is Audrey Michelle, host of Rewired Life Radio and a spiritual growth coach. I talk about this all the time on my show, listening to your body and acting on intuition. What do these things even mean? Here's the thing. About 10 years ago, I figured out I was doing it all wrong. I mean, I wasn't unhappy, but was I really happy? And then life sent me a spiritual smackdown, like it does, because I wasn't listening to my best resource, my body and my intuition. I was living from a place of fear. I was stressed and I was in pain, and I seemed to be happily unhappy. Mostly, I just didn't know what I didn't know. And what I didn't know was that my body and my intuition had all the tools I needed to live life as my best self. I'm sharing the tools I have learned over the last 10 years of my healing journey in my online class, Soul Awakening, beginning September 19th. Learn more. Go to audreymichelle.com/awaken. That's Audrey Michelle, spelled michelle.com/awaken.
Have you been seeing numbers like 111 and 222 everywhere you go? Do you feel that the universe may be trying to get your attention, perhaps offering a message of some sort? As it turns out, numerical patterns in certain types of geometry form the very fabric of our reality, from cells under a microscope to the astronomy of our night sky. At Stellar Reflections, we offer special sessions which tap into these patterns, designed specifically to support you on your journey. The 111 and 222 activations are sessions activating new patterns in your energy field, which in turn can help you create new patterns in your life. After just one session with a practitioner, either in person or via distance, clients report gaining greater clarity, becoming more intuitive, and honoring their inner truth as they move forward in their lives. Curious about what these transformational sessions might do for you? Call 425-999-9836 or visit StellarReflections.com. That's StellarReflections.com. Welcome back to the Christine Epchurch Show here on KKNW and Transformation Talk Radio. I am having a fascinating conversation today with Douglas Knoll, author of four books, including his latest, De-Escalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. Okay, Doug, I know that we're going to be talking about more of the work that you've done in prisons. I'm fascinated with how you apply this in daily life, let's say with a spouse or a coworker.
So if you practice, this is like learning how to ride a bicycle. In the beginning, you're going to be probably going to have training wheels on and be really wobbly. So this is not something that I can just tell you how to do, and you're going to be able to do it masterfully. It takes time and practice. But once you practice it and begin to see the results, then it becomes a part of your everyday persona. Every day, I live in the mountains. I drove up to our mountain store 15 minutes from where I live. Picking some up at the grocery, and I'm walking out, checking out with the clerk, and say, "Hey, you look really happy today." And all of a sudden, the person's just beaming and just start telling me about what a great day she was having and everything. And I just put an affect label for 30 seconds. They just do it naturally. Because you see, when you listen to somebody like this way, you listen them into existence. You're giving them the precious gift they don't get very often, if at all, which is really being validated as a human being, the word you used earlier. And that's exactly correct. So it just becomes a part of your everyday life. And all of a sudden, you have nothing but happiness around you. There's just some really cool things that happen. I'll say one other thing just to entice people, because this is the kind of show where I think I can get away with this. There is a spiritual practice involved here. When you listen to somebody in the way that I've described, and there are biophysiological reasons why this is, which I won't go into, but what happens is you become egoless. And just as Eckhart Tolle talked about the power of now, being in the presence of the now, and not looking in the past and the pain body and all that stuff, this is the actual practice that will get you there. Because when you're focused on the emotional experience of another person, you don't have any space to be anything other than one with this other person. And you feel this transcendent oneness for about 15 or 20 seconds.
Right.
And you just move into this spiritual space, which is extremely powerful. Not only is it powerful for you, but it's as if you are in an energetic bubble where you are being totally shielded from anything energetic or emotional this person can throw at you, and you have nothing but compassion flowing out of you.
Right. There's an acceptance of what is, which from my perspective, from the energetic perspective, it's a powerful pivot point to transform.
That's right. And this is something that every time you do this, you're going to have that experience. So if you do this 4 or 5 times a day, you're going to have transcendent experiences for 15 or 20 seconds, 4 or 5 times a day. How cool is that?
That's great. And you don't have to, withdraw from life and be meditating for an hour to get there.
No. You don't have to meditate or do yoga or do any of that stuff. You can if you want. My wife says I love doing yoga. we got a sign that says I love doing yoga or something. And she said, no, I'm just kidding. I drink wine in yoga pants. something like that.
That's pretty good. I like
pretty
that.
Funny.
Oh,
but
okay.
She's a spiritual practitioner, and I mean, we use these techniques and we teach them because they're so powerful for helping people who are the listeners grow themselves, their own spiritual lives. So it's very powerful. This stuff just works at many, many different levels.
Right. Well, yeah. There's one issue that I see with getting people to do this. They're going to have to be comfortable with emotion, and you know that includes their own emotions,
right,
in order to be able to accept others.
Correct.
How do you get to that point?
Let me tell you about our first experiences teaching this in prisons, women's prison, this violent women's prison back in 2010. When Laurel and I devised the curriculum for all of this, we decided that we could not teach anybody, any inmate, how to become a mediator because they just didn't have the skill sets to do that. So we had to teach them foundational skills, and we decided that in the beginning what we would do is teach them these deep reflective listening skills. That was going to be our foundational skill. If they could master that, then ultimately they could learn how to resolve conflict. So we started teaching this first group of 15 women, and the pushback and the anger and the resistance and the fear we got them stunned us. Stunned us. Well, what it turned out was that these women had all been raped and brutalized and addicted, and I mean, they have had horrible lives. That doesn't condone what they did, but you got to understand, these people are, these human beings I mean, well, we had one 20-year-old girl who said, this prison's the safest place I've ever been in my life.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, her story was typical. She was she was molested at 3 years old by her uncles, and her mother began to get her addicted to heroin at 8, began prostituting her at 12. She killed her first guy at 13, her second guy at 14, and is now in life in prison without possibility of parole.
Oh, my goodness. So
that's
victim herself.
Typical story.
Yeah.
So anyways, but what happened was we pushed them. We kept working with them. We had a lot of compassion. I was challenging them because I was this big white lawyer guy. Every bad thing that ever happened to them was a big white guy.
Yeah.
And so we had to build a lot of trust, and it just took time. But eventually, about week 6 into our initial training, these thorns, these women who were so shut down and so brutalized, we come in one day, and all of a sudden they've turned into these beautiful roses. Because all of a sudden they learned that their emotions are important, and they've learned how to deal with their emotions. They would openly say, "I don't want to be emotional. I'm not emotional. I can't be emotional." And ultimately, it said emotions hurt too much. And then, as they learned how to affect label and they learned the power of listening to other people's emotions, it slowly opened them up to their own emotional experience, and their true humanity started coming out. Half those women, those first 15 women, all long-termers and lifers, half of them have been released.
Oh, my goodness.
One of them, the one who wrote us the letter, was an LWOP, life without possibility of parole. She got a sentence commutation. It's probably getting out. She'll be out before the end of the year.
Oh, my goodness. And you think in terms of when somebody gets released from prison, what they're going to bring into the world, and are they going to be able to, you know, live healthy, happy lives, or are they just going to create... problems, you know. So
that's right. And are they going to cycle back in? Are so far as we know, we have about 600 inmates that we've trained who have been released, zero recidivism that we know of.
And compare that to a typical statistic.
That's right, where you got 65%.
Zero versus 65%.
Right.
The former statistician in me says that's incredibly significant.
Yep, it works.
Yeah.
This stuff works.
Yeah. Wow.
So people are, you know, many people in our, even if on the outside, this is why I'm taking outside of prison to teach people this, that we are afraid of our emotions. Mm-hmm. We've been trained from the time we were 2 years old to be, that emotions are bad. Yeah. Males especially bad. As a young boy, I skin my knee or stub my toe and start to cry. What am I told? Stop crying. Don't be a sissy. Be a man.
Tough it
up. Suck it up. Right. Life is tough. Get over it. Right?
Yeah.
What am I being taught every time I'm told that at 2 years old?
It's not okay to feel.
It's not okay to feel. So what happens then when I'm 15 years old and I want to have a relationship with a girl that I'm interested in?
I don't know. You tell me.
It's a train wreck.
Yeah.
It's a train wreck. And all the science shows that when you do not have access to your emotions, you lack what is known as emotional granularity. That's where violence comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Because instead of being able to process your emotional experience, all you can do is lash out.
Right.
And domestic abuse, for example, is all the studies are showing that men and women who engage in domestic violence, they don't have emotional granularity. They've never developed the database of emotions, the cognitive part of what an emotion is.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are just working off reactive patterns that were drilled into them at the time they were 2 years old.
Okay, so let's talk about dealing with conflict in that kind of situation where there's, say, verbal or even physical abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Can you de-escalate that using this approach?
Same way. Now, we tell our inmates, and I tell everybody I teach this to, don't ever, ever, ever put yourself in danger. If there's a chance of physical violence, get out.
Uh-huh.
Get away. But that's rare. So people can be quite verbally violent, and not really step over the line to physical violence.
Mm-hmm.
But even if they're verbally violent, this works beautifully when people are that escalated. You're really angry. You're really mm-hmm. frustrated. And go deep and find out what you're feeling like. Nobody listens to you. You feel completely abandoned, unloved,
mm-hmm.
and you're feeling a lot of sadness.
Okay, so I'm sure that in some relationships, people are going to wonder if it's going to be reciprocated. So,
it's not.
Okay. So
it's
how,
a learned skill.
So how do you deal with it if you're really good at the de-escalation, say, within the context of, you know,
right.
a romantic relationship
mm-hmm.
or a business partnership,
right?
And then the other person doesn't learn the skill?
Christine, that is a great question. The answer is there's not much you can do except get other people to buy the book or watch the video courses and learn how to do this themselves.
Uh-huh.
Find a cadre of people who are willing to do this so you can find people who will really listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
But short of that, the other thing that I've observed over time is when people learn these skills and they master them over a period of a couple of months, they are now able to de-escalate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they can literally self-soothe by saying, I'm really angry, I'm really frustrated, I don't feel heard right now, I don't feel listened to, I don't feel validated.
Uh-huh.
Just by being able to do that yourself literally calms down your own emotional centers. And that's the first and highest step of emotional intelligence, is being self-aware.
Yeah.
Able to label your own emotional experience, that's the first step of developing emotional intelligence.
And I find it fascinating that if we can observe and validate our own feelings, that shifts our you know, physiology, our brain
yes.
chemistry. That's fascinating.
For the reasons that Lieberman showed us. If we can process our emotions, we're no longer slaves to our emotions. If we can process them and cognitively understand what we're experiencing and just acknowledge them, all of a sudden things start to calm down, because the whole reason that we have emotions as human beings is to pay attention to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And emotions are just there like big flashing lights saying, pay attention, there's something out here that you got to pay attention to.
Right.
Once you acknowledge the flashing light, the alarm goes off, and now you can deal with it. But if you don't deal with the alarm, it's just going to get louder and louder and louder and louder until you deal with it.
Yeah. This is incredibly powerful. We have to go to another quick break, but stay tuned for more with Doug Knoll.
Calling all moms, it's time to awaken your vibrant, intuitive, loving self in every area of your life. Join host Debbie Pokornik as she shares thoughts, stories, and tools to help you stand in your power. Listen to Vibrant, Powerful Moms helping everyday women create extraordinary lives, Mondays at 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern. For more information about Debbie, visit empoweringenergy.com. That's empowering with letters NRG.com.
I'm Christine Upchurch, and this is a Stellar Reflections Minute. As a former research statistician, my scientific background is what many would call sensible. For more than a decade now, I have been working in the field of energy medicine, facilitating sessions and teaching around the world. People from the mainstream often ask me, how did a sensible woman like you end up working in such an alternative field? Implicit in their question is the underlying assumption that the field of subtle energy, such as energy healing and intuition, isn't sensible. But I believe it is very sensible. Even scientists are able to measure aspects of this. Approaching life from an energetic perspective brings us new opportunity for healing and transformation. And from a practical standpoint, even if you can't rationally explain how something works, if you experience a shift from it, then doesn't it make it pretty sensible? Please visit StellarReflections.com or call 425-999-9836. That's 425-999-9836.
Wow. Hey, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to the Dr. Pat Show. This is Talk Radio to Thrive By. I'm telling you, I got to pinch myself some days, because when each of us gets called to do something that we so not thought was in our wheelhouse to do for a purpose that's so much greater than us, we get to show up and shine.
If you would like to show up and shine on the Dr. Pat Show as a co-host or sponsor, send us an email to inspire@thedrpatshow.com.
Is traditional medicine not working for you? Do you still feel as if your health isn't 100%? Here at the Holistic Medical Center, Dr. Nushin Darvish and the qualified staff look through the dimensions of wellness and start a healing plan prioritized to your needs. Our physicians assess the whole you until complete health is achieved. Get the help you need by visiting drdarvish.com or call 425-451-0404.
Welcome back to the Christine Upchurch Show. You know, we are having a really important discussion about conflict and how to de-escalate it and how to help ourselves and others heal based on just how we respond to our emotions. Now, before we go any further, Doug, you know, one of the things I've found a little bit perplexing within the consciousness community is some people think that, okay, we've got positive and negative emotions, and I don't have a hard time sort of categorizing them that way. But some people will say, oh, well, the positive emotions are very spiritual and the negative emotions are somehow unspiritual. What's your perspective on that?
So it's like saying I shouldn't feel disgust because everything that is possibly edible, even if it's deadly, poisonous, or rotten, I should put in my mouth.
I like that analogy.
Come on, give me a break. Yeah. There's a fair amount of controversy around this, but I'll just lay out my theory. I follow a psychologist in the 1960s by the name of Sylvan Tompkins, and he came up with a 9 affect model. Affects are the biophysiological things that happen in the brain that ultimately lead to what we call an emotion. Mm-hmm. And he determined from studying infants that we have 9 basic affects. 2 of them are positive, 2 of them are neutral, and 5 of them are negative. And we are hardwired for these emotions. Wow. So saying that an emotion is spiritually good or bad is really not the right way to look at it. It's really, what is the purpose of the affect, or what's the purpose of the emotional experience? And it's our response to our emotional reaction that determines whether or not we're enlightened or not.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to deny the fact that you're experiencing anger or shame or humiliation or rage or fear is sort of pointless, mm-hmm. because you're just denying your own biology.
Right.
But if you can look at that and say, what is the, you know, label yourself or have somebody label you, validate you, and then say, all right, what's the cause of this? What is out there in the environment that needs to be dealt with right now? That, and then manage that that's the higher calling. So, you know, people label emotions as bad, negative emotions, fear, anger, rage, all that stuff. They say those are bad. Well, they're bad because they feel bad, mm-hmm. and they feel bad for a reason,
right?
To make us pay attention.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the people that cuddled up to the saber-toothed tigers 250,000 years ago didn't pass their genes on to us. We're the inheritors of very paranoid genes.
Right.
And that's what it means to be a human being.
Speaking of paranoia and conflict, it brings me to the environment of politics and government and the, you know, even on social media.
Right.
How do we deal with this in a healthy way?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, when we're dealing with people on social media, obviously there's no cost, no social cost of being snarky, mm-hmm. or being rude.
Right.
But I have found on all of my social media sites that when I affect label, I say, oh, you're really angry, you're really frustrated, you don't feel like you're being listened to, that they tend to go away. Uh-huh. It works in social media. It's amazing how it goes away. People just go away.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how I deal with the snarkiness and the rudeness. I just treat them like they were sitting in front of me and label their emotions and they go away.
Uh-huh.
But political polarization is a real issue. And the unfortunate thing is we don't live in a culture right now where our role models, the people who are our political leaders of whatever persuasion, mm-hmm. are role models for civil discourse and respectful conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And they get elected because they cater to tribalism,
sure.
and that becomes more polarizing.
Right.
So what do you do at the dinner table or somewhere where you're confronted with somebody who has radically different beliefs that are actually repugnant to you? How do you even have a conversation with them without going crazy?
Mm-hmm.
Here's how you do it. The first thing you do is recognize you have to be the adult. 2, do not try to persuade them about anything. And 3, your need to be validated has to be put aside at the moment.
Right.
So you have to engage them. And the way you're going to engage them is by simply asking a couple of really simple, open-ended questions. The first is, you know, I'm really interested, Christine, in all of the life experiences that you had that led you up to the beliefs that you have today. Could you take a few minutes and just tell me what in life led you to what you believe in today?
You want me to really do this on air?
No, but so I'm going to get your story.
Right.
And then out of your story, we're going to start seeing some common ground.
Uh-huh.
And I'll be de-escalating and affect labeling you and reflecting back to you so you know you're being heard. And eventually, we're going to begin to get an understanding of where these beliefs come from. The second question I might ask is, how do your beliefs help you in your everyday life? How do they guide you in your decision-making and how you see the world? And what do they do for you? Most people never get asked that question. So they have to think about it. How do my beliefs organize the way I... Because that's all beliefs are. They're just heuristics that help us make decisions.
Sure.
That's all they are. So how do they help you? And then the third question I might ask is, how do you deal with people who have different beliefs than you do? I mean, not everybody agrees with you, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you manage that? And that's when you'll get kind of... People will get a little defensive and say, well, I avoid people or I just want to kill them or whatever. And then you just get engage them and say, well, no, come on, really. What do you do? How do you manage that? And should we even live in a society where different beliefs are possible? And if so, how do we manage that?
Right.
You notice that in all these questions, I never once asked a person what their beliefs were. I never attacked their beliefs. I never tried to convince them of something different. All I wanted to do is find out what in their life and in their behaviors and the way they see things, how do their beliefs work for them? And when you do that, you will find more common ground than you can possibly imagine.
So you go into their story as opposed to the beliefs themselves.
That's right. Because the science shows us, again, our brains are very quirky. Here's another quirky part of the brain. If somebody has a very deeply entrenched partisan belief, and we challenge that belief with facts that are true, objectively true, but inconsistent with that belief, what happens in the partisan's brain is that dopamine is released. Dopamine is the pleasure neurochemical, neurotransmitter.
Yep.
And they actually get pleasure in holding on to their belief against the objectively true but inconsistent fact. They get stubborn.
Right.
That's what stubbornness is.
Okay.
And so when you try to confront somebody with, wait a minute, how can you have this belief? Here's the facts over here. All you're going to do is make that belief more deeply entrenched. So that's pointless. Arguing with somebody is pointless. It's pointless. You have to go about it a much more indirect, subtle way. Enlightened way.
This is such important work, Doug. And I know that you've got a special offer for listeners here in the United States in the near term. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I've been blessed with a person who wants to support the work and get this book into as many hands as possible. So for a limited time, as long as the money is there, we can offer the book. We can offer to buy the book. We basically buy the book from Amazon. If you pay the shipping, we'll buy the book and ship the book to you. And this is good for U.S. residents only because of the way that Amazon operates.
Uh-huh.
So if you would like that offer, go to DougNoll.com, DougNoll.com. Click on the banner. You'll go to the order page, and $7 handles the shipping and handling, and the book will come from Amazon. If you're outside the United States, can't offer that, sorry to say, but the book is available at Barnes & Noble, Books a Million, Indie Books, online, everywhere. This book is being published by Atria Beyond Words, Simon & Schuster. It is a mainline publisher. It is available wherever fine books are sold.
Yes, and
so just go online or to your bookstore, wherever you are. If they don't have a copy, they'll order it. It's available everywhere.
And we will be posting the archive of this interview up on ChristineUpchurch.com. Go to the radio show page, and then we'll go down to Doug Knoll. And when you open that, we'll also have the link to the free book offer on that.
Perfect.
Okay, Doug, we've just got like a minute and a half left. Do you have any last-minute wisdom for our listeners?
You know, my life has gone through so many interesting twists and turns. I would just say this. Don't be afraid of the darkness. I've walked into some very dark places and brought light. And that's what we can all do. If we're willing to open our hearts and not worry necessarily about financial consequences, but if we're just willing to serve humanity and help other people, then really wonderful things can happen to us. And if you told me 10 years ago that I would be working in maximum security prisons teaching murderers to be peacemakers, I would say you're absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
And yet that's, you know, part of what I do today, as well as help other people resolve conflict. So you just never know where life's going to take you, and you just have to be open to it.
All right. And this is just beautiful work. And again, I highly recommend the book, De-Escalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. And if you live in the U.S., oh my goodness, you can get it for free. Doug, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Christine. It's been a great conversation.
And thank you for joining us here today. If you want more information about Doug's work, go to DougNoll.com, DougNoll.com. If you want more information about my work or listen to any of the archives, go to ChristineUpchurch.com, ChristineUpchurch.com. And I look forward to talking to you again soon. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Christine Upchurch Show, stellar conversations to illuminate your journey. Each week, this show engages some of the most outstanding visionaries on the planet in lively dialogue to inspire you to become that bright light you're meant to be. Join Christine every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time on KKNW, AM 1150, and TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information about the transformative healing work of Christine, visit www.StellarReflections.com. And for weekly topics, visit www.TransformationTalkRadio.com.